Welcome once again to BM Cairns Talking Arts program. We run a podcast. We were running live events last year, and this year, because of the pandemic, we're just doing podcasts with people. And well, I'm here with Wendy Chai, and she's going to introduce her guest. So over to you, Wendy.
Thanks, Brad. We've got a very special guest today. And I'm really delighted that these are the second time we've had both Judith Martinez and Craig Billingham with Talking Arts. Because Craig, you were here in our Nolan on Lovell Gallery doing an interview with Rowana Gonsalves.
That's right, back in March, I think it was.
Yeah, just scraped in. And Judith, you were one of our first people that we included in Talking Arts, so way back at the beginning.
At the Carrington.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And everybody was absolutely fascinated with what you were working on and your history with Spanish, your relatives, and I think people just wanted to hear more. So we've got you both today, a creative couple. Craig is a writer-poet and a teacher. And Judith is an illustrator, artist, designer.
That's right.
Yeah, so, and both very accomplished, and they're local. And I've had the pleasure of knowing them for quite a while, and I think they're really beautiful people, so I'm really glad we're having this interview today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy.
I actually remember from Judith's podcast, a lot of people have asked since whatever happened with Judith's trip to Spain.
Okay, really?
So, yeah, so this is the full circle. This is finally people are going to find out what happened with that trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, you sparked a lot of interest.
Did I?
Yes. And even like our last podcast with Natasha Daniloff, there was a lot of cultural history because she's got Russian heritage and very still infused with the history of Eastern Orthodox faith and so forth. And as she was talking, I was thinking of you and thinking how interesting it would be to you have the conversation fleshed out in multi dimensions like that. Mm.
Well, we had sort of a deja vu moment because she talks very visually as well, mm-hmm. and so you know your mind, especially people who are involved in filmmaking like I am, you start thinking about what it might visually look like on a trip. But of course you start imagining a Tarantino film where people are running along the top of trains going through tunnels in Europe, you know, with all the sort of stuff you were talking about. But but she had a very sort of similar sort of visual style to which is great for a podcast, you know, when you people are trying to imagine, you know, what's going on. But her family history stuff, the work she does with her family history, because she takes old documents and heat transfers them to materials and then puts them up, like as a performance piece, mm-hmm. you know, sort of as an installation piece, is brilliant, you know. So,
Well, that's a good lead in. Perhaps Judith, we can start with you. She's looking very reticent. Oh, look, I'm going to roll out the red carpet for you. Okay, so. The last time we were talking to Judith, she's doing a Master's of Philosophy at Sydney?
UNSW Art and Design. I've just finished that, actually.
You've just finished?
Yeah, well, I submitted the thesis and have been awarded the degree.
Oh, congratulations. What a relief.
It is a relief, but being one for a sucker for punishment, I'm applying for a PhD next, I hope to continue the research because I really enjoy doing research-based creative work.
Let's go from there. Tell us about what you're doing. What was your MPhil and how do you see that morphing into your PhD? So tell us a bit about your research.
Okay, so for the MPhil, my fields of research were memory studies and archive studies. And I broke up the creative component. I broke it up into what I called archives. So I did three different archives, and each one was responding to a collection or stories. The first one was I did one based on the archive at the Rocks. So using artifacts that were found at the Lilyvale archaeological dig site, which were little bottles, I I responded to that with did a photo media work, and that was at the Rocks Discovery Museum. So that was one archive. The second one was my own personal collection of vernacular photographs.
Can you just explain vernacular photographs?
Of course. So vernacular meaning like the everyday. So instead of things that are bureaucratic or official, these are the photographs of everyday people. And I collect them. So anywhere from the late 1800s to the late 1940s, I draw the line 1940s. And so what I do is I take a figure from these photographs and I create a new narrative for them. So that was another archive. And
just before you go,
yes,
when you say create a new narrative, what does that look like?
Okay, so being photo media work, most of my work is digital. So I work on a digital platform. But then I look at substrates, so what materials that I can print those new narratives on. And I'm very much drawn towards metal and fabric. And that's part of the process as well. So there's the conceptual component, which is creating the narrative. There's also the finding the photograph and taking new photographs to create that narrative. And then there's the production part, which is finding a substrate that is suitable for what I'm trying to create and experimenting with that.
Now, if we went to the Lost Bear website,
mm-hmm.
would we see some of this kind of work?
Yes, that's excellent.
So if you're listening and you've got your computer in front of you, go to www.lostbear.com.au
Yes.
And look up Judith Martinez, and you can have a look at some of her work while you're listening to the podcast. Mm-hmm. So it would help flesh out some of these
ideas. Yeah,
it's
very well documented.
Yes. Good. And I'm having visions of your work while you're talking, so I think it will help people to see too. Yeah, so what was the other one?
The third archive was I treated the apartment that my family have rented in Spain for over 100 years as a site of memory. So I documented that as a space, but I also documented the objects within it, and then with the photographs that I found there as well, I started creating individual bodies of work responding to these images that I found in the house. Yeah.
Which was what sort of captivated the people who were listening to you when you were speaking to us before, I think.
Yeah.
That just, and the adventure.
Oh,
your history, your grandfather's history.
And that still hasn't happened yet. When I was doing my final lot of research, I was at the archives at the Universidad Complutense in Madrid, and I met the author and the archivist of this big project called Arte Protegido, which means protected art, translates to protected art. And it was exactly what my grandfather was part of. Getting the artworks from the Prado that were in danger of being destroyed during the Civil War, and getting them out of Madrid and to a fortress in Valencia. So when I was doing my research, I was trying to find my grandfather in the archive, and I did. I found some documents. The archive is fragmented because after the Civil War and a dictatorship, etc., they're still trying to put it together, although the dictatorship was over 40 years ago. But meeting Isabel Alderich, who's one of the authors of this book, we were talking about it, and she said to me, it's too big for an MPhil, leave it for a PhD. So I actually parked it, and it's just been there on my shoulder. So while I was writing my MPhil thesis, it was really difficult to not tap into that. But her advice to me was that her own her book, and she worked with another author called Judith Ada. They took them 25 years to get this project completed. So I thought, okay, I can be a little bit patient. put it aside for a few.
I mean, it highlights that any of that sort of research is a time consuming process.
Very much so. Yeah.
It's good that you made the contact with her though, because you've drawn her into your project. So while she's doing her research, you know, she's obviously got you in the back of her mind. So has she contacted you since?
Well, or? I'm actually going to, I have a Zoom meeting with Judith Ada, the other author, on Wednesday. So hopefully that goes well, and we'll be discussing the project. See where that takes me.
Yeah.
I'm dying to start it, I have to say. And I have put it on, as I said, I've put it on because of advice from professionals. I thought, okay, give it the attention that it needs and devotion that it needs.
Mm. Well, that's always the thing, that you can rush it too much and mm-hmm. sort of want to release something or put something together mm-hmm. before you've got all the material together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that you can step back and go, no, yeah. it's going to take this long.
And it is going. I think that might be my opus. You know, I wonder if we'll be having a conversation about this in 10 years' time, going, well, actually, I'm up to the...
Done chapter one.
Yes.
of the book that's going to accompany the exhibition.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But that must be, that's one of the nice things. I mean, living with Judy and this project has been discussed now for the last 2-3 years, maybe more than that.
I found it. I found the paperwork 2 years, 3 years ago. Yeah.
So imagining what you're going to do with it as being part of it, and I think that.
And you get a sneak peek.
I get a sneak peek. Yes, I get to hear about it, and so I know certain things about Judy's family that she discovered 2 years ago that other members of the family didn't know. I was actually there at an exhibition that Judy had in Spain when her cousin came in and saw one of the artworks that Judy had done of your grandfather, wasn't it?
Mm.
And Judy told him a little bit of the results of the research that she'd done while in Madrid and discovering something about her grandfather, and he burst into tears. He was quite emotional because it was revealing some part of family history which no one had known. And it changed his attitude and his perspective on his own grandfather, which was quite amazing. And that's one of the great things about family history. And this one is, you know, connected to such a significant event in Spanish history as well.
Yes.
They're the sort of instances you want a film crew standing up.
Yeah.
Catch those tears.
We'll have to bring you along to the next trip.
Yeah, that's right.
It's in Madrid. The food's good in Madrid. you come with me. She can go and do the research and I'll show you some of the bars. Yeah. That'll be all right.
Sounds like the perfect holiday. Working holiday. Okay, so we're excitement about the PhD coming up.
If I get it.
Yeah. Oh, I would say, well, I can't say anything. No, it's not my place to say, but to have that sort of sense of excitement in anticipation of that is wonderful. What a great, rich resource you've got there. But I was also thinking when Craig was sort of responding to what you're doing and him watching what's happening, I'm also thinking Craig is also, he's a PhD, he's been through a PhD, knows the process of research and what that creative field is like.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into what that's like as a couple and working together, Craig, tell us a bit about who you are and what you do and what your practice is. And
I'm a primarily a poet, but also a fiction writer. And my doctorate was in, I wrote fiction that was, it started out, it was a project that was based around the Australian poet Michael Dransfield, who died of a, he died of a drug overdose in 1973. And I was interested in him. I was born in 1973. I came to Australia in 1987. So in a way, it wasn't my history, but I was interested in what was Australia like in that period before, before getting here. I'd heard so much about Michael Dransfield that I thought, well, I'll do a bit of research, which I did. And while trying to, I then realised I don't want to write about an actual poet, so I will write about someone who is loosely based on Dransfield. But I just found that the power of the narrative around Dransfield was such that I didn't have enough room for my own creative work. So what happened was that I ended up developing a different character who was then telling the narrator about his relationship with this Dranfield type poet. And I became much more interested in the fictional aspects of it rather than in the archival aspect of it. So that allowed me to deviate a little bit. I also got concerned about the ethics of writing about someone who's family is still alive and who is so well known, and decided that I didn't really want to do that.
Okay.
I subsequently published an essay which tries to deal with a little bit of those issues, which was called On the Novel I Did Not Write.
Okay.
And so I wrote about that, and I I don't know. I'm still in two minds whether I just shot myself in the foot, whether it was cowardice that stopped me doing it, or whether it was the ethics of trying to write about someone. And so I moved away from that and concentrated more on this fictional poet that I called Paul Benneker. And I wrote a novella around him, and then with some other stories which were connected thematically. They were connected to biography and to questions of who has the right to tell certain stories and to represent certain things, and which is very current in literary mm-hmm. studies at the moment, and in Australian culture generally, I think, as it is around the world. But it
makes me think of the Kate Grenville story about the early Australian around the Hawkesbury River,
and
that came after that about its accuracy and who's going to tell the story, or who's going to tell the most accurate story.
Yeah,
what's fiction, what's truth,
and I think that for me, I was interested in what's fiction and what is how do we remember things and who remembers them, and around Indigenous history, of course, it's oral storytelling has been the way of doing that. So how have those stories developed over time, and what does that mean in terms of the origin of the stories, and what has changed? And equally, what happens if a settler nation develops, and then that particular culture writes the history of the culture that it's decimated to a large extent? So there are all sorts of things. That wasn't an area that I was looking at particularly, but I was aware of those things. And Kate Grenville has had some fairly high-profile arguments with historians about that. My own feeling is that you have to tread very carefully, and that the idea that there is a truth that needs to be told is, I think, a little bit... I'm a little bit suspicious of that notion. I think it's often an artist's ambition or a writer's ambition, and then they suggest that it's a truth that needs to be told, and really it's just a really good story that they want to get involved with.
And I
think the ethics gets forgotten a little bit, and perhaps should be.
Especially if they find out that the story is not as exciting as they originally thought, if there's a bit of boredom in there.
That's true.
Oh, that was a bit mundane. I thought he jumped off the building. No, he walked down the stairs and it was fine.
And then what do you do with that? What do you, is there a, are you, is there some kind of obligation to what,
do you tell a truthful story or a better story?
And what does that do? And I suppose it's about your intention. Why are you
And I imagine you and Judith have quite heated arguments about it, because Judith would obviously be come from the more historic point of view, because she's telling her stuff in a different narrative, you know, but she's still doing a lot of historical research, so.
And still creative as well, so Judy
and interpretive,
that's right, and I think that's an interesting thing, how we do take stories, and all artists, writers do this, but then you put your own spin on it, you put your own interpretation, and what are you doing by doing that? You know, if you can... historical accuracy is something that I don't want to have to worry about in fiction, and so therefore it means that I am happier writing something which I would, you know, for want of a better term, talk about as being imaginative or creative, in a way that historically based fiction or biographically based fiction can't be. Having said that, I'm interested in a form of fiction called autofiction, which is the idea of a narrator writing in the first person as the author. So if it was me, it would be, I might call my narrator Craig Billingham, and then write from that point of view. And I could give you all a chapter of something like that, and you wouldn't know whether I was writing pure autobiographically based work, or whether it was completely imagined. And what does that say about even our own histories, as well as more collective or social histories that we might get involved in?
It sounds like you're sort of treading into the territory of psychotherapy a little bit too.
Well, a friend of mine is now, he's a playwright, and he's gone back to university to study therapy, and he's interested in something called narrative therapy.
Oh, yes, which is that whole idea of
you know, if you have a particular, he was telling me recently, if you a patient may go in and suggest that there's something that is troubling them, and the therapist might say, well, let's imagine a narrative where that thing that is troubling you is outside of the frame, as it were, and we'll deal with it over there. And this is a way.
So there are those things.
One of my great heroes as a writer is J.M. Coetzee. And he wrote a book called The Good Story, where he's in dialogue with a psychotherapist called Annabelle Kurtz. And it's fantastic, where they debate the difference between memory and fiction, and what you should do if you do have a particular memory which is traumatic. How might you get beyond that? Or if you could take a pill to forget it, would that change the person that you are? This sort of thing.
It's, very interesting.
Well,
there seems a little bit of overlap there too, in terms of memory and remembering accurately, and how that sort of works out.
And changing the construct of
remembered
memories and things, you know.
Yeah, we do share a lot of readings. Craig is very good at he's always reading, and he's always finding really interesting articles and books, and then that leads off on, you know, they're like breadcrumbs to other readings. So we're always helping each other with our research that way.
So your biography, what's the word?
Bibliography.
Is sort of like 10 times longer than everybody else's because you've got a research assistant, is that right?
Twice as long as mine, because she gets to do her own thing as well. And then, that has been interesting, the way that we have been able to share some things. And back from Judy to me, I'm now more interested in memory studies, having had an interest in that. People like Marion Hirsch, and others who Judy's introduced me to. And I find that... thinking about that in terms of fiction, as Judy does in terms of visual art, has been quite interesting.
But do you write a lot, Judy, when you're doing your research? Do you write a lot down?
I do, yes. Well, because...
But you've never published the research?
No, or just my thesis is on the university library website, but no, I've not published my research.
Oh, sure. Okay.
But I did everything I wrote was responding to the research and also the creative components of it. So it is something I would like to do, but let's see.
Well, you could always pass it along.
Ghostwriter. Yeah. We could come up with a pseudonym. We've already got a pseudonym.
We have worked on projects together. I mean, Judy doesn't need my help with her academic writing, because she writes so well and knows her field much better than I do. So, you know, that's a one thing. But creatively, we've worked together where Judy will do the artwork, which I can't contribute to at all, because I might come up with ideas, but I can't actually produce anything.
Sure.
It's a bit unfair, because when it comes to the writing, Judy can improve a paragraph or
suggest
a sentence. So I feel like, you know, it's
imbalanced.
It's a bit imbalanced, yeah.
That's not completely true. We were saying before how we're always the first, Craig is the first viewer of my work and I'm the first reader of his work.
Yeah.
And it's not always rosy. Sometimes we have arguments about it. There's this, our favourite line is... Oh, it's not my favourite of yours.
That comes in.
Shucks. Yeah. Back to the drawing board.
Yeah, that comes in quite a lot, actually. I know Judy can be quite. when I was doing my thesis, my supervisor happened to be called Judith as well, Judith Beveridge, and my mother is called Judith.
So
you know, the three Judiths.
Poor, wanting to.
And they all had that way. My mum, not necessarily reading my own work, but they certainly my supervisor and Judy here were diplomatic, but were honest, let's say. Diplomatic but honest. And you have to then respond to that, don't you?
That's
one of the things we learn as creative people, is that others will have a different perspective, and often one that opens up a different avenue for you to pursue. That certainly happened with my work.
Yeah. So do you see that as sort of like you're extended by, like, say, your wife, Judith, when she participates or reads, and then says, this isn't my favourite work of yours, but she might say, do you comment further? Or
oh, is it definitely. Sort of, it's not just like, that's not my favourite, and walk away. Great. And then that's not always the conversations. There's some, you know, very beautiful bits of prose that I'm being exposed to at the moment that I thoroughly enjoy. And it's just, you know, saying, oh, well, why don't you evolve that a little bit more? Or sometimes it's perfect. Sometimes it doesn't need anything else.
Yeah.
But it's always nice to have that initial filter of an opinion you respect.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah.
Close by before anybody else sees it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that whenever I'm doing any artwork, for whether it's corporate or creative, I'd always ask my wife to come over and have a look at it first, because, and her reaction invariably is totally opposite to what I expect. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, oh, this is my favourite logo, or this is my favourite bit of design that I like, and she'll just come over and go, oh no, this one over here is great, you know, and I'll sort of go, oh no, you're right, it is, it's great, you know. She's also good at interpreting what a client might like. I'll just describe a client to her, and she'll go, oh no, she won't like that. She'll hate that, you know.
Because, well, I suppose you can be too close to your own work. No?
Oh,
I
mean, of course.
There are certain things which I don't show anyone, even Judy. I would be, because of superstitious reasons, I think. But I'll know at what point I do want to share it, and Judy will...
That's interesting. So you actually have a couple of little rules. I don't show anybody.
I was like that when I was... I did a master's of creative writing, and when I was doing that, I really disliked going into a weekly workshop with something that I wasn't happy with. I wasn't someone who could write something the night before and take it in and read it to a group of 8 or 10 people. I would work on it and there's always criticism, and things can always be improved. But it had to be at a stage that I was happy with it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't want anyone seeing it.
Yeah.
And I still do that. I mean, I've got something I'm working on at the moment that Judy has seen. She probably sees the part that I've finished, but she doesn't see the part that I'm currently working on, because I push it a little bit further, and then I will read her the part that I've polished to see what she makes of that. But, I don't know if you're... Yeah. I don't know when I get to see... sometimes quite early.
Sometimes, yeah. I think, well, the good thing about sharing work with, if your partner is creative as well, is that you feel less vulnerable when you are showing it to the rest of the world. So there's that initial reaction, seeing how someone reads it, interprets it. So to me, that's really valuable, because I, by nature, I'm not an extrovert, so I struggle to put myself out there in most cases. So to have someone at home to be able to have a look at that and see what Craig's reaction is very important for me as well.
And you also, I think of it as an advantage that Judy has over me, in that you often will have something coming up, like, you know, you have a show coming up in December, so you're working towards it. I'm not the... I publish fairly regularly in journals, etc., but I'm not the level of writer who has publishing contracts and is told, okay, you know, by this particular date, you must have a draft of your novel. That's not my experience. Whereas for you...
Well, let's hope it is soon.
Well, possibly. but for you, you do have that where... And you work really well with deadlines.
Yeah, I'm getting a little... I do work to deadlines. I'm very deadline-driven, and I think that's because of, you know, working as a designer for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I am getting increasingly more tired to work. You know, working to deadlines is getting... harder, I find. And I think it might be an age thing, but I think it's also, I think that, you know, different interests, sort of, the, you know, doing art and design, doing two things, and then throwing in now research as well, academic research. So there's a lot. So I am finding that leaving things too, you know, too close to deadline is getting harder.
Getting harder. Because you are, so you're juggling the three... your academic, your graphic design work as a professional, and the artwork. So you're juggling those three professions, if you like. Mm. So it's wearing thin.
It is, I think so.
Wow.
I think
it is. So if there was a choice that you could make in terms of direction, are you at a point where that's an option, or...?
to be honest with you, if I could choose right now, so if there were, you know, if I didn't have to think about any consequences or anything, yep, I would go down the track of creating research-based artwork. Yeah, so sticking to those two things.
And I think a lot of creatives, that's the story, you know, they have work with, that they do to bring in an income, and then they have their side projects. A lot of people think, I would love to just do my side project all the time, you know, that'd be great. But a lot of them, when they do jump over, they find they tend to slow down the rate of work.
Yeah.
Would you think you'd find that? Is that if they're doing commercial work and then, I've only got tomorrow to get that research and that initial test of that graphic style or whatever it is, that technique for my artwork, does that put pressure on so that you get that thing done quicker? Whereas you would, if you were just doing it, you might take a week.
I wouldn't know, because I've always worked to deadlines. So I've had to undo that. But I do find that for many years I felt a little bit, how could I put it? Because I felt like I was more a designer than anything else, I didn't feel like I could call myself an artist. But now I find that all these years of design, all all the practice, all the creating digital work, the production, that's fed so seamlessly into my artwork. So I don't want to be ungrateful for the design. I think it's really served me well.
There's also the aspect of we are a creative couple, but in terms of our professional lives, Judy has had a more consistent professional life than I have. I've worked in project management and in teaching and these sorts of project management within education, and I'm a university tutor currently. But it's not, I think with creative couples, there's often one who has more of a, carries the load more financially, and that over the course of our relationship has probably been Judy. I think not all the time, but mostly that's been Judy, and that's something I think that is one of the disadvantages when you are a creative couple, that you have to juggle that a little bit. It's not as if we often
think, I think you may have just admitted to it might be time to step up.
Well, yeah, I know. Yeah, the poetry's
that's
not
the problem with a creative couple. You can't actually step up when you want to step up.
It's difficult because there is a fairness and an equity issue there. And in terms of time, you do feel that. I mean, I think it's been more equal in the last, or it had been more equal for 2 or 3 years, but then it's gone back because of the current situation with university teaching.
Excellent segue there, Craig.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
We need to. We need to.
Wendy's
ask
been
you.
Waving that.
Yes. It's true. It's sort of affecting us all in so many different ways, isn't it? Because I was wondering that about you, Craig, actually, because you're a sessional teacher, aren't you?
That's right.
There's so few permanent staff in universities now, so it's really very difficult to be permanently employed at a university. It's a rare thing. Mm. And I was just wondering how it's affected you, because there's so many cutbacks and people have lost their jobs and... So
yeah, I've seen my own. I'm working fewer hours this semester than I would like, certainly, and fewer hours than what I've worked in the last, let's say, 2 or 3 years. So it's certainly had an effect. I am one of the fortunate ones who still has a little bit of teaching.
Yeah.
But even so, it's there's no guarantee of what will happen next semester, and there's a lot of uncertainty around higher education generally and around the humanities with what's going on with fees and will there be students, what will happen with the number of students, number of classes.
And will you only have really wealthy students in your class?
Yeah, so all of those sorts of things. I teach at the at Western Sydney University, and our the university is very much committed to its area, its community, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with student numbers over the next little while. Whether more students are encouraged to go into university because their employment prospects aren't so good, or whether there's a great fear of taking on debt when it may not be that they're going to be guaranteed work afterwards. No one's guaranteed work, but yeah. it's more difficult now than it has been. So, yeah, that's that has been a difficult thing. Judy, though, has been teaching as well. So she's added teaching
to
four
things.
That's right. Yeah.
Dearie me.
So it's actually nice to be able to spend this half an hour, 1 hour with her, because this is the most I've seen her in the last 6 months, probably.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah, so has the COVID thing affected your hours too in that respect?
Not as much, because it's just something that I, like a small amount of work for me, but it has changed the routine of it. So, when you're doing a research degree, you get a bit of teaching as well.
Yeah.
And I was travelling down to Sydney and doing the face-to-face tutorials, and then week five, term one, it all changed and we had to go online, and it was very strange. So I'm still teaching a few tutorials online. It's difficult. Once again, by nature, not being a huge extrovert, I find it difficult to just stare at a blank screen
to
for
perform
4 hours.
On.
Yeah, yes.
It is it's
on
a
camera, because it's a much more. We talked to a couple of people about it. It's a much more of a performance-based thing where you've got to get your ideas across and engage the people a bit more.
There's a performance. People don't respond back. A lot of times you ask a question and there's no answer because, you know, that person's just gone away to make a cup of tea or something. But I'm lucky that the classes I do teach into, we've got the conveners and the tutors, we have a good relationship, and we all sort of try to catch up before class and share information, what we're going to do. There's a lot of planning.
A lot of prep
planning and prep.
So,
interesting times. But even the way, it's not only that, it's everything. So, for my research, having to meet up with someone through Zoom for a meeting. So I think there's a negative and the positive, where it's become a lot more open. I also did an interview recently in Argentina with a group of Argentinian artists, and I think if we hadn't had COVID, and I'm not being a Pollyanna about COVID, I think COVID sucks, but if we didn't have COVID, we wouldn't have access to this technology, that it's opening a lot of doors for people to communicate in different ways. So I don't think I would have had this interview with these artists in Argentina if it wasn't for that. But at the same time, I do find that, although
it's a very strange concept, because it's like, you know, it's it's not a nice thing to have to meet your neighbours in a bomb shelter, but yeah, a lot of the time you'll find out things about them in that bomb shelter that you would never have found out.
That's a really good way of putting it. And I do find that, you know, the art experience is suffering because of COVID. I've got this exhibition coming up at the end of the year. I'm struggling to be inspired, but also just thinking about
it's removed that aspect, that exhibition and the whole thing of an opening.
An
exhibition.
No opening, and also a reduced audience when I think about how many people see it. So then there's that added that you have to think about how you're going to record it and how you present it in a different way.
And also I think that not necessarily for you, but I've been thinking of this in terms of my own work, everything just feels so trivial compared to the things that are going on in the world.
Right.
Yes. So, you know, sometimes I feel very fortunate to have extra time to be able to do my work, and I'm able to concentrate and focus and produce work that I'm happy with. And other times it just feels quite trivial, and you don't know what's going to come from this particular work. And you know that there are people who are, you know, it's a very difficult time for others. In a way that it isn't necessarily for me personally, or even for us in New South Wales compared to Victoria, or even in Victoria compared to what was going on in the US, Spain, what's going on in India, what's going on in wherever it may be. So so there's that sense of proportion and perspective.
Yes.
And how do we actually think about our own work in those terms?
I think I relate to that, Craig. I think the sense of, well, the meaningfulness in the work that you do, it's almost like you shifted from something you thought was really substantial, but in the light of the weight of the world, if you like, it's sort of like, well, is this helpful? Mm. Like, is this contributing?
And I'm also interested to find out how artists feel about responding to the pandemic, whether or not they're going to produce work related to the pandemic or not, and how they feel about doing that. Do they feel that it's something they would want to do, or do they feel, no, it's too early, I don't want to respond to the pandemic during the pandemic?
I think it's too early. I think it's marketing people going, right, what are we going to do? Let's hit the designers and artists. And and I find that when it started and it was really bad in Spain, and I have a lot of friends in Spain who are artists, and this idea of all cultural institutions saying, oh, at home with an artist, and they do a little video, what are you working on? And it's almost like every artist in the world went, great, pandemic, I'm going to create. And they were, all the marketing people were trying to tap into that. And a friend of mine who runs she's got this amazing residency place outside of Gijón in Asturias in the north of Spain, she just wrote something one day online saying, just let us rest. We're not performance monkeys.
Yeah, right.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I think people will inevitably it will appear in people's work, but it might not be explicitly about the pandemic. It might be about feeling withdrawn from others, or the experience of being exhausted, or the experience of feeling that your work is trivial, whatever that
losing
may,
direction may
be.
Or
having to work in a new medium because of where you are.
Actually, that's very true.
You can't be a performance artist if there's no performances. So try and do something else, you know.
You can't print if you don't have access to a press. There's a lot of things, a lot of compromises.
And I think artistically as well, it's almost like sedimentary layers that there are. It takes a bit of time for them to build up, and for them to come to the surface. So, you know, I'll often write things which are about. If I'm particularly with poetry, I'll write something that might come about from thinking about something that happened in my childhood or 10 years ago, or when I lived in a different country or a different place or whatever it might be. I don't necessarily write about things that are going on in my immediate vicinity or in the time that I'm currently living in. I'm sure that this COVID experience will be coming back to artists for a number of years, and you know it's there'll be great work done about it, and there may be great work done about it very, very soon by people who are set up differently. But I think a lot of us will ponder it for a while, and it'll just sort of emerge in some form.
I'm just thinking of the work of Locus Jones and how he uses the newspaper or news media. It's almost like he's been given some sort of structure to enable him to express what's going on with COVID. But for the rest of us, we enter into this sort of nebulous, not even knowing how to process it within ourselves, let alone produce something material with words or with images.
And I haven't seen Locus Jones's work, if he's done any recent work on with newspapers on COVID. I have seen things in the past. And I would imagine that something like that work, yes, it'll have a currency, but imagine seeing that in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, where he is able to present those works which reflect back. And so we see the newspapers which were from that particular time. I think it'll be more effective and more affecting at that particular time, because we won't remember it with that detail.
The same.
At the moment, I feel I wouldn't want to look at it because I feel absolutely saturated in. I've stopped watching the news on television. I'm not looking at the news online as often as I was. I'm just... I just find it until there's something new to be told.
Yes.
Which we're all waiting for the vaccine, aren't we?
Yes.
Until then, I just
I tell people I'm just punch drunk from the news. Yeah. You know, it's just too many hits. You know.
Yeah.
Bushfires and
Well, that's what I think.
Pandemic and killer hornets and.
With the bushfires, quite a few local artists did respond and went out and made work based on that. I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't face that and create work around it, nor even looking at work that was in the bushfires. I mean, my house wasn't particularly under threat or anything, but I just needed space and time to be able to come to it with some sort of emotional distance or something. Look, I'm conscious of the time and that we'd sort of said we'd have 30 minutes, but we're still going and could go forever and ever. Have we sort of talked about what you're both working on now? You've got an exhibition
at
the end of, at Lost Bear?
No, at the Cultural Centre. So I've got an exhibition at the Cultural Centre.
Exposé?
Yes, I do.
Oh, Judith, how could I forget that?
It opens on the first week of December, so I'm working towards that.
Wow.
Yeah, busy with that.
Okay.
Freaking out about that.
Is that a large exhibition?
Yes, well, Wendy had one recently.
Similar to Wendy's one.
Same space. Very different.
Very different, cool. I would imagine.
Yeah, so that's what I'm working towards.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And are you able to really concentrate on that? Have you got time, space?
I'm trying.
Okay. I just got to see, before we came up here today, I just got to see one of the works that Judy, a new work that Judy is putting together for that. I got to see the first, we have a little printer at home and it was a print of something that she's been doing. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a feeling that that's going to be the next thing to take over our lives will be Judy disappearing into the studio to do this work, as well as all the other things she's doing.
Yeah,
that's very exciting. Mm-hmm. So 1st of December, did you say?
The first week of December.
December. So, at the Cultural Centre Gallery in Katoomba.
Yes.
The expose, do you have a title for the...
Yes, Revenant.
Revenant.
Yes.
Tell me what revenant means.
Revenant is the idea of a ghost that comes back, so the person that comes back. And I'll be using antique photographs and reinterpreting those photographs. Initially, the exhibition was going to be something else that was responding to archival research, but because of the pandemic, I had to start responding to my own archive of photography. So I've gone back to my own photographs. I was very lucky that last year... a friend of mine, Penny, from who's in Lura, she turned up with a box full of antique glass plates from France. So they'll making an appearance in the work.
And how do you present those?
I'm actually trying something new with those. I'm trying to work with lightbox, take photographs through light boxes, but then have them printed on photo rag paper. That's what I'm trying to do. And try, once again, that idea of creating a new story. But I'm trying to do my layering in an analog way instead of a digital format for part of the work. So that's because it's a large space, there'll be different bodies of work.
Yeah.
I'm also working with a lot of antique cabinet cards. So, you know, the little portraits that people used to give each other in the late 1800s, working with those. Some copper pieces, and I'm hoping to do a projection. Right. There's a lot of experimenting. So a busy couple of months.
I admire the fact that that's all ahead of you yet.
Oh,
well, you have some things which are ready.
Of course.
Yeah, but there are new works, aren't there?
And it's sometimes I don't know, Judith. I find the momentum as you get closer to the time and you've been working away. The momentum increases and the inspiration. We'll see.
It's called a deadline.
Yes. Yeah.
That's very exciting.
It is a little bit scary. You know, with deadlines where you've created something or you've started creating something and it's working, and then because it's a body of work, the second one might not work the same way. And it's like,
And when you're reliant on technology too, the sort of risk factors around things not coming together or
that's true.
Not working the way you envisaged and that sort of thing.
But there won't be an opening. There'll be a small artist talk, I think the second week of December.
Well, my experience is the artist talks often attract quite a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So it may be that that's sort of the substitute of the opening. But the opening is such it's an event, isn't it?
It's fun. They're fun.
You might have to do a couple.
I don't think so.
No?
A couple of talks.
Yeah.
But let's put it to the Cultural Centre. Yeah, see what they say.
See what their budget, how far their budget
goes. They usually rely on your generosity to do that.
Well, they have a thing where they encourage the artists who are in the show. So we were recently in the Black and Blue show that just closed last weekend. And they were encouraging artists to come in on weekends and be available to talk to people.
Yeah.
But there is a reduced audience.
Yeah. And they don't pay you full rates to do that.
They don't pay you anything.
No, okay. All right. Well, that's why I was saying I've been involved with Sharon out at Gang Gang Gallery, and that's what she's doing for her opening next Saturday.
Okay.
Is she's not having an opening, she's just having artists come in all day and talk. And yeah, she's just had to ask them to do that, you know. But everybody's really keen, so everybody's sort of adapting.
Yeah, let's see what happens by December. What the what restrictions are, how many people can be in a room, etc. But it's such a beautiful space that I'm looking forward to seeing the work up there.
Yeah, excellent. Well, that's a good incentive for everyone who's listening.
It's a great large open space. Are you going up the wall? You're going like, because Wendy went quite a way up the wall.
I'm going a little bit up the wall, but not completely up the wall.
I mean, that was my original proposal. I wasn't going to do anything else. I was just going to go up the wall. So that was what I thought was going to happen. But I'm sure it'll be a beautiful exhibition.
I'm nervous about it.
that's healthy. Yeah. Craig, what are you working on?
Nothing quite as exciting as that. I've recently started. I don't know, Wendy. Actually, I should ask you because I know you did your PhD, and was there a bit of a time lag?
I did MPhil.
You did MPhil?
I haven't done a PhD.
After the MPhil, was there a bit of a time lag while you were almost getting that out of your system?
Oh, yes.
And then it took you a little bit of time before you started creating work, which was separate from the body of work you'd done.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's good. Absolutely. Yeah, because that's what has happened with me. I finished probably about 18 months ago the thesis and the creative work for that. And then I was really just playing around with it and pushing it around the desk and doing various things, changing a few commas, a few full stops, that kind of stuff. Whereas in the last month or so, I've started something completely new.
Good.
I can see connections to it in terms of things that I'm interested in anyway, memory and biography and that kind of stuff. But this is a much... I think it'll end up being... I don't feel any pressure from an ethical point of view with this, so I don't feel any issue with that. I'm very comfortable with what I'm writing, and we'll see where it goes. But I'm hoping I'm enjoying
it. You get up in the morning,
great, isn't it?
Start writing.
Yeah, no, that's nice to be doing that again, because that's mostly been missing for the last, I'd say, the best part of 18 months.
And look, I think we totally underestimate what's invested in doing that kind of research and working towards something like that, and the cost that it, you know, our whole bodies and mind and everything goes into it. So I think that's very healthy that it's taken you 18 months. I mean, you need to give yourself creative space.
Yeah, I think so. And that seems, I'm glad that, you know, I'm not glad that you had the same experience in terms of, would have been, what
but
have
we're
you...
all different, but you know, for me it was like I couldn't go near it. I needed creative distance. And then you sort of know in yourself when it's time to come
and back. You're writing this for yourself, and that's the difference. For the period of the PhD, you were writing for a specific audience, and you were doing academic writing, and the creative writing you were doing was responding to that research. But something's happened to you in the last couple of months where there's been a switch in your brain or something, and I can see it, you're writing for yourself.
And I won't have to explain. I won't need to explain it or contextualize it with a scholarly piece of work.
Yeah.
I can do this and just, you know, it stands by itself. Whereas the thesis was the creative component, and then in creative arts it's called an exegesis, where you write about your about your work. And it's a wonderful thing to do, a great opportunity to think about your work in that depth. And I wouldn't...
Do you find you're tempted to go back and change the work when you're doing that?
What I found
when you're explaining it in a way that somebody will understand,
I found that I shaped it for submission and to fit with my thesis, and that I submitted and I was happy to submit. But as soon as I received the notification that it had been accepted, I then wanted to change certain things in the creative component. And loosen it up a little bit. And in fact,
because the pressure was off.
It went from being a let's say a 45,000 word collection of short stories down to being a 36,000 word loosely assembled novella, let's say.
Right.
But I'm much happier with it, and now it feels finished and I've moved on from
it. You can move on.
Yeah.
Something that I'm hearing from what you're saying, Craig, is freedom is a really important part of your creative process, having the freedom to go where you want without the restrictions of, oh, is this accurate, or is somebody going to be offended, or is this ethical? It sounds like that's really important.
Yeah, that's been good for me. And in a way, it's been a process of writing something which in many ways is much simpler, sort of, you know, not worrying about the academic side of it or the theoretical side of it, which I think can, some people do that very well, and for others it can be quite harmful to their creative practice. And I think that's why, you know, for anyone who would want to pursue that, it's very important that you have that in mind, and to think in terms of what are your intentions for the work, who is the supervisor, what are the requirements, how are you going to negotiate your work with your supervisor and with any peers who are involved. And it is quite difficult. I mean, Judy's just finished an MPhil and is now hoping to jump into a doctorate, and she has that advantage of having worked out how to do it.
Yes, it's a good flow through.
I just thought, I like doing this, so I'll extend it for as long as possible.
That's so good. I think I was too exhausted at the end of my MPhil.
Oh, it is exhausting. When you submit that thesis, and it's such a good feeling.
Yeah.
And now start all over again.
Yeah, that's right. Keep yourself a breather in between. All right, let's wrap up with...
We should do the housework and find out where people can go and find your work. Online sources.
I'm very discreet online, so you can find me on the Lost Bear website.
Right.
So that's lostbear.com.au.
So that sounds like a good place to get a...
Yeah, you can see my work there, and also I have a gallery that represents me in Madrid called La Factoria de Papel.
Right, okay. So the URL for that.
and you can see my work there. But my own website is something that
we'll get the link. We'll put it up on the Talking Art.
Thank you.
Blog, so people can find it.
Yes.
I have a couple of short stories that are online, freely accessible, on a literary journal called Verity La. One story there called Breakfast at Bethany's, and another one called The Love Scene. So those two stories are available. And then poetry on a number of sites, but including a fantastic site called Red Room Poetry. And Red Room Poetry is just worth spending a bit of time on, having a look at some of the projects they do, back into, they've done work into high schools, primary schools, jails, whatever it may be. And I was fortunate enough to be involved in a couple of their projects, and they've got a few poems on their site as well.
And your essay?
Oh, and the essay on the novel I did not write. Yeah, that's right. That's on in a journal called Text, which is a journal that comes out of Griffith University and is about, it's a scholarly journal about creative writing, but they also have some creative work and some essays like mine, which are not peer reviewed, but hopefully are interesting to people who want to take a look.
Excellent. Did we get that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Wendy.
Really interesting. As having conversations with you both before, we should have sort of phase one, phase two, phase three, just to sort of track your career.
My case sevens. Yeah. If I ever get around to it.
Yeah.
Especially at the moment, it's just nice to be with a couple of other people who you can have a good conversation with.
Yes. You didn't provide hand sanitizer, Brad.
No, it is here.
That's there.
I know. It's all
individual bottles of water, hand sanitizer.
He's very well prepared.
COVID safe.
Very well prepared. Oh, very good.